have demonstrated the value of the psychological immune system and the personal qualities that keep it healthy. Behavioral economists and many psychologists have shown its downside. They find that unless kept very carefully in check, optimism, self-affirmation, and the related positive qualities generate a bias that leads to overconfidence and potentially dangerous decision-making and risk-taking across virtually every profession and business examined closely. No matter how careful the screening and how impressive the individual's track record, the optimistic bias of yes, I can, it also comes in the form of yes, I know, leads these highly skilled, successful professionals to take on excessive risks, even when they are honest, well-trained, well-intentioned models of lifelong rigorous self-control and self-discipline. These risks can easily end in disaster, and the people who are vulnerable to making such mistakes periodically bring their own success to a screeching halt when their overconfidence leads them to breach social norms and ethics, which often lands them in the headlines. The scandal of General Petraeus, director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, illustrates the power of perceived immunity from consequences. This is an instance of the HOT system going full force, even though the probability of exposure is glaringly obvious to the COOL system. Four-star General David Petraeus was widely esteemed, serving as the poster boy for COOL cognitive control. He personified Spartan self-discipline, including daily jogs at dawn for many miles in the hills of Kabul when he commanded the troops in Afghanistan. He was appointed head of the CIA in September 2011, but was quickly brought down in November 2012 by a long string of emails that revealed details of his adulterous love affair with his biographer. The correspondence was uncovered by the FBI, and it led to the general's immediate resignation. The tragic irony of his situation, or depending on your perspective, its absurdity, is Shakespearean. Hubris, the Achilles' heel. The Petraeus story reminds us that even the almost invincible hero Achilles of Greek mythology had a vulnerable heel, the one exposed hotspot that could bring about his own downfall and that made him human. Nevertheless, while recognizing that we all have hotspots that make us vulnerable, we still expect that people who are excellent at self-control will also be more alert and sensitive to delayed long-term risks. As discussed, high delayers are better protected against experiencing stress, and this in turn can make them less sensitive to danger signals. Likewise, because they tend to experience more success and mastery over their life course, from better physical health to higher financial gains, they may be more predisposed to some costly decision biases, particularly as a result of the illusion of control. As Petraeus' story illustrates, the illusion of control can cause a formidably competent, high self-control person to reveal information over email that can undo the successful life he built. The consequences of the illusion of control can be catastrophic, particularly in some financial risk-taking situations when high self-controllers may feel in control and then fail to react appropriately to external feedback and danger signals. This happened in the real world during the financial disaster of 2008. In 2013, it was simulated and analyzed by Maria Konnikova at Columbia University in five experiments on risk-taking when money was at stake, albeit not in the billions. Staying calm, optimistic, and self-confident, the high self-controlled decision-makers disregarded the feedback about their losses, were shielded from stress, and lost more money than the low self-controllers who became anxious sooner, responded to the feedback, and quit before they went broke. In the end, in some conditions, it is the low self-controllers with their lessened confidence and heightened anxiety who can end up ahead. The benefits, however, may not last. The researchers induced heightened illusory control in the low self-control participants by having them succeed in predicting coin flips or getting them to recall times when they had made good decisions and had been in high control situations. Feeling more confident, these participants quickly lost their initial advantage. They started to resemble the high self-controllers and to make the exact same poor choices and lose money as a result. From bedroom to boardroom to burned feet. Reviewing the paradoxical literature in which the I think I can optimists not infrequently mess up their lives and the lives of people who depend on them, Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel laureate in economics and my colleague in psychology, points out an optimistic bias plays a role, sometimes the dominant role, whenever individuals or institutions voluntarily take on significant risks. More often than not, risk takers underestimate the odds they face and do not invest sufficient effort to find out what the odds are. He then presents powerful evidence that optimism creates enthusiastic inventors and energetic, hardworking, courageous entrepreneurs who are eager to seize the day, but whose confidence also fosters their delusions and leads them to minimize the risks and suffer costly consequences. Asked about the probability of success for any business like yours, one-third of American entrepreneurs said their chance of failing was zero. In fact, only about 35% of such businesses in the United States survive for 5 years. This seems to hold for everything from a small bed and breakfast venture to a Silicon Valley startup promising the next big thing. At the very least, it may be reassuring that optimistic entrepreneurs are even more likely to take excessive risks and make unsound bets with their own money than with other people's money. Thomas Ostebro, a researcher who studied the fates of almost 1,100 new inventions submitted by eager innovators, found that less than 10% of them reached the market, and of those that did, 60% got negative returns. Half of the inventors withdrew after receiving objective reviews predicting that their inventions were sure to fail. But 47% of the remaining half persisted, doubling their initial losses before quitting. 6 out of the roughly 1,100 inventions scored big, however. They yielded returns exceeding 1,400%. Those are the kinds of high but extremely unlikely and unpredictable payoffs that cause unrelenting optimists to continue buying lottery tickets. Those odds also keep them pulling the levers on the slot machines and rolling the dice after performing little rituals to increase their luck in the gambling casinos. A schedule of reinforcement that delivers a big payoff at rare, unpredictable times can, in experiments, keep pigeons continuously pecking on a lever forever, as B.F. Skinner and his students demonstrated, and it can seduce gamblers to keep losing until they can't get another loan. It also gets optimistic entrepreneurs and innovators to keep working thousands of hours in the hope that they will become the next billionaire. The dangers and costs of overconfidence are not restricted to the world of entrepreneurship and financial risk-taking. They apply equally to any experts who are optimistic enough to make predictions about outcomes that are subject to chance or largely unknowable. In one study, for example, the diagnoses that highly competent physicians made while their patients were still alive in the hospital's intensive care unit were compared with what their autopsies later revealed. Physicians who had been completely certain of their diagnosis turned out to be wrong 40% of the time. Early in my career, I lost many friends in clinical psychology by calling the field's attention to the discrepancy between the confidence with which clinicians predicted outcomes, like the probability that particular psychiatric patients would return to the hospital within a few years, and their consistently stunning lack of validity. The predictions of renowned expert diagnosticians were no more accurate than those made by untrained bystanders. The weight of the patient's folders summarizing their past psychiatric history was by far the best predictor of the incidence and speed of the rehospitalization, greatly beating any combination of the best tests, extensive interviews, and expert clinical judgments. I discovered the problem of unwarranted confidence in experts' predictions not just by reviewing other people's failures. I found it in my own research. I worked with the first Peace Corps project that sent young volunteers to teach in Nigeria in the early 1960s. While the volunteers were undergoing training at Harvard, we used a costly and elaborate assessment process that relied heavily on interviews with trained experts, faculty ratings, and a battery of cutting-edge personality tests. In a final meeting that lasted many hours, an assessment board representing experts from a variety of disciplines and with diverse experiences met to discuss each individual volunteer and reach a consensus about his or her personality characteristics and likely success in a teaching position. There was high agreement among the ratings from these diverse sources, and the assessors were confident about their usefulness for predicting how well each of these volunteers would do on their assignments in the field. A year later, the assessment board's predictions proved to have zero validity. They were not significantly correlated with the performance ratings reported by the volunteer supervisors in Nigeria. In contrast, the candidates' simple self-reports about their attitudes, qualities, and beliefs had at least moderate predictive value. While this experience was shocking at the time, in retrospect it turned out to be prophetic. A similar lack of validity for expert predictions made in this manner has been shown to be the rule whether in long-term forecasting for the stock market, the behavior of psychiatric patients, the success of business enterprises, or virtually any other temporally distant outcome, as fully documented in Kahneman's 2011 book, Thinking Fast and Slow. In short, the psychological immune system protects us from feeling too bad when our predictions fail, but it can also keep us clinging to beliefs in the face of evidence that persistently contradicts them, leading us to make mistakes that have high costs. Optimistic illusions can be hard to disconfirm, even when they burn your feet. In July 2012 in San Jose, California, 21 people had to be treated for burns after attempting to walk on hot coals, as inspired by a motivational speaker extolling the power of positive thinking. Burned feet notwithstanding, in further testimony to the power of the psychological immune system and the human ability to reduce psychological dissonance, many of the people who had tried it apparently felt, after they cooled their feet, that it was a transformative, positive experience. Even when the prefrontal cortex doesn't protect us, and I think I can leads to burned feet, the psychological immune system keeps doing its work. 14. When smart people act stupid. As impeachment loomed for the President of the United States in 1998, a reporter called me to ask if we could trust what President Clinton did when he was working at his desk in the Oval Office, now that we knew what he did under it. Other reporters were less direct, but they had the same concern. Their questions reflected the common belief that qualities like self-control, conscientiousness, and trustworthiness are broad traits that characterize a person's behavior not only stably over time, but also consistently in many different kinds of situations. It assumes that a person who lies and cheats in one kind of situation is also likely to be dishonest in many other situations, whereas one who is conscientious will be predictably conscientious in diverse contexts. These expectations are violated each time the headlines announce the fall of another famous person in a position of public trust who turns out to have a secret life, exposing a side of his personality that appears to be the opposite of his public self. Predictably, a torrent of speculations follows that always raise the question, who is he really? President Clinton's pattern was hardly unique. One of the most stunning examples of such an inconsistency in behavior was the fall of Sol Wachler from his position as Chief Judge of the State of New York and the New York Court of Appeals to incarceration as a felon in federal prison. Judge Wachler was famously revered for advocating laws to make marital rape a punishable crime and was deeply respected for his landmark decisions on free speech, civil rights, and the right to die. After his mistress left him, however, the judge reportedly spent months harassing her, writing obscene letters, making lewd phone calls, and threatening to kidnap her daughter. How did this model of jurisprudence and moral wisdom turn into a handcuffed prisoner on his way to jail? Judge Wattler attributed his own behavior to his problem with an uncontrollable romantic obsession. One expert asked about Wattler suggested that he might have a brain tumor the size of a baseball. He didn't. The headlines announced similar stories about celebrities and public figures in the entertainment world, religious institutions and pulpits, business, sports, and academia. No area is exempt. Tiger Woods, the golf star hero, was the personification and ideal of rigorous self-discipline. Not just in mastering his physical skills, but in his sensational capacity to focus his attention. He was a supposedly happily married man, but he ultimately confessed to a private life with mistresses that violated his well-cultivated public image. The sports idol suffered one of the more memorable instant falls from grace, or at least from public celebration, for a while. In time, his descent was followed by that of the world champion marathon cyclist Lance Armstrong, whose career and extraordinary life were tainted by a doping scandal. Contextualize self-control. How do you explain these folks, reporters invariably ask. They want a short answer for their deadline. I give them the shortest version. President Clinton had the self-control and delay ability to win a Rhodes Scholarship, attain a Yale Law degree, and be elected to the U.S. presidency. Apparently, combined with little desire, perhaps no ability, and certainly no willingness, to exert self-control for particular temptations like junk food and attractive White House interns. Likewise, the judge and the golf star had the self-control skills to excel in the pursuit of their most important career goals, but not in other contexts. To be able to delay gratification and exert self-control is an ability, a set of cognitive skills that, like any ability, can be used or not used depending primarily on the motivation to use it. Delay ability can help preschoolers resist one marshmallow now to get two later, but they have to want to do that. Whether or not self-control skills are used depends on a host of considerations, but how we perceive the situation and the probable consequences, our motivation and goals, and the intensity of the temptation are especially important. This may seem obvious, but I emphasize it here because it is easily misunderstood. Willpower has been mischaracterized as something other than a skill because it is not always exercised consistently over time. But like all skills, self-control skill is exercised only when we are motivated to use it. The skill is stable, but if the motivation changes, so does the behavior. Many celebrities and public figures exposed in the headlines probably did not want to resist their temptations. On the contrary, they often seemed to expend considerable effort seeking and pursuing them. Their optimistic illusions and inflated self-worth shared with the rest of humanity, but perhaps even more grandiose in them, made them feel invulnerable. They did not expect to be caught, even if they had been in the past. They also believed that if they were discovered, they could still get away with it, which is not an unreasonable expectation for some given their past experiences. Their histories of success and power may also encourage them to spin entitlement theories that exempt them from the usual rules and encourage them to do what less powerful people can't. As Leona Helmsley, New York's billionaire ex-hotel queen, was alleged to have said before beginning her prison term, "Only the little people pay taxes." If they don't make remarks like that, their prospects for redemption usually remain excellent even if they are exposed. Modern-day fallen heroes often rise phoenix-like from the newspaper ashes that announce their downfall to host television shows, run news and interview programs, or become well-compensated consultants. The ability to exert self-control and wait for marshmallows implies neither that it will be exercised in every domain and context, nor that it will be used for virtuous goals. People can have excellent self-control skills that they use creatively for good purposes valued by society. They can also use the same skills to create hidden families, offshore bank accounts, and secret lives. They can be responsible, conscientious, and trustworthy in some areas of their lives and not in others. If we look closely at what people really do, not at what they say, across different situations with regard to any dimension of social behavior, it turns out that they are not very consistent. The consistency paradox. When we look at the people we know, nothing is more obvious than that they differ greatly in their social behavior and characteristics on whatever dimension we consider. In general, some are much more conscientious, sociable, friendly, aggressive, quarrelsome, extroverted, or neurotic than others. We make these judgments easily, and we mostly agree not only with one another, but also with the self-perceptions of the people we're judging. These widely shared impressions of what we are like are very useful, indeed vital, for navigating the social world, and they allow us to make reasonable predictions about what to expect from other people. Situations also influence social behavior in an important way, depending on how they are perceived. Regardless of how conscientious a person tends to be or not be, most will be more conscientious about being on time when picking up the kids from preschool than when meeting a friend for coffee. And they will be more sociable and extroverted at large parties than at funerals. That kind of variability is evident. The conception of human traits, however, makes an additional assumption, namely that an individual would be consistent in the expression of a trait across many different kinds of situations in which the trait is desirable. It is assumed that a highly conscientious person will be more conscientious than a less conscientious person consistently across many different kinds of situations. If Johnny is judged to be much more conscientious than Danny on the whole, then he should also be ranked higher than Danny on his completion of homework assignments and on his attendance record, as well as on how conscientiously he keeps his room organized at home, and how trustworthy he is when he babysits his younger sister. Is this assumption justified? Does the person high in any important psychological trait generally remain above the person low in that trait across many different kinds of situations? The assumption that people are broadly consistent in what they do, think, and feel in very different situations is intuitively powerful. It is fed by the HOT system, which quickly forms impressions from the smallest slices of behavior and generalizes them to anything that can more or less fit. But does it hold up when we use the benefit of the prefrontal cortex to look closely at what people really do across different situations, whether it is President Clinton, our family and friends, or ourselves? When I was preparing to teach my first course on assessment as a new lecturer at Harvard, I started asking these questions. Can you use your work partner's conscientiousness at the office to predict how conscientious she will be at home? Can I predict how my colleague, who is known as the loose cannon at department meetings, behaves at home with his children? To my own surprise, study after rigorous study failed to support the core trait assumption. People high in a trait in one kind of situation often were low in that trait in another type of situation. The aggressive child at home may be less aggressive than most when in school. The woman exceptionally hostile and rejected in love may be unusually tolerant about criticism of her work. The patient who sweats with anxiety in the dentist's office may be cool and courageous when scaling a sheer face of a mountain. And the high-flying business entrepreneur may avidly avoid taking social risks. In 1968, I undertook a comprehensive review of the correlations that had been obtained in dozens of studies trying to link people's behavior in one situation, such as conscientiousness about meeting obligations and commitments at the office, to their behavior in another, such as conscientiousness at home. The findings shocked many psychologists. They revealed that although generally the correlations were not zero, they were much lower than had been assumed. The researchers who failed to demonstrate the consistency of behavior across different situations blamed their failure on having used imperfect and insufficiently reliable methods. I began to wonder whether the problem might be that their assumptions about the nature and consistency of human characteristics were wrong. While the debate continued, it did not change the fact that across-the-board consistency of a person's behavior is generally too weak to be useful if the goal is to accurately predict from his behavior in one type of situation what he will do in another type of situation. Behavior is context-dependent. Highly developed self-control skills may be exercised in some situations and with some temptations, but not in others, as the stories of fallen public figures regularly remind us. This raises problems in everyday life, and those problems became vivid for me when I needed to hire someone to take care of my young children for 2 weeks while I had to be abroad. I considered my neighbor's babysitter, Cindy. She said she got good grades in high school, had worked as a lifeguard the previous summer, and did not smoke. She seemed to be a nice kid, and the neighbors agreed. But I also knew, as I described above, that we usually cannot predict accurately from one situation to other very different situations. For example, how would Cindy behave at parties with her peers when the alcohol was passed around? We also couldn't predict, based on how she behaved babysitting one particular evening, how she would behave when babysitting my kids for 2 weeks straight. Yet that is how automatic impressions are formed. We compress bits of information into a compelling simplification, a stereotype that makes us feel that what is true in one situation is also true across other situations. Even highly confident, well-trained experts who often get it right also often get it wrong, especially when they try to predict specific behavior in different, new situations. I did not hire Cindy. She seemed too young. But I did hire a young couple who appeared mature and responsible. They made a very good impression on me during a long interview and visit to meet my children, who liked them. When I returned from the trip, however, I found the house transformed into a major mess, with 10 days of unwashed everything waiting. The kids survived, but they were very unhappy and had developed an intense dislike for the couple, who had developed an equally strong dislike for them. My interest in doing more research on the consistency or inconsistency of behavior, particularly self-control and conscientiousness, intensified. In time, my research team and I did find consistency, but not where it had been expected. We found it by looking closely at what different individuals did when we unobtrusively observed them hour after hour, day after day, over the course of half a summer in a residential treatment camp for children. It was a natural laboratory for seeing in fine-grained detail how a person's behavior is expressed over time and across situations in everyday life, and it yielded some surprises that changed the understanding of personality. That story begins at Wedico. 15. If-then signatures of personality. Wedico is a well-established summer residential treatment camp in a bucolic New England setting. When we conducted our research there, children aged 7 to 17 lived in rustic cabins for 6 weeks in small groups of same-sex peers, similar in age, with about 5 adult counselors per cabin. The children were referred to the program because of significant social adjustment problems in their home or school, particularly problems of aggression, withdrawal, and depression, and they came mostly from families in the Boston area. The goal of the camp's therapeutic environment was to enhance more adaptive and constructive social behavior. My long-term research colleague Yuichi Shoda and I were allowed to do a large-scale research project at the camp in the mid-1980s, thanks to the staff at Wedico and Jack Wright, who was director of research at Wedico Children's Services. Jack, Yuichi, and the research staff systematically observed the behavior of the children over the course of the 6 weeks. The researchers extensively but unobtrusively recorded each child's everyday social interactions across a set of diverse camp activities and settings, from cabin time to time at the waterfront and in the dining hall, during arts and crafts, and so on. It was a massive data collection effort, and Yuichi and I collaborated with Jack on planning the project and analyzing the findings. Finding the hot spots. The observers recorded what each child did during his or her interactions with others in the same set of situations day after day over the course of the summer. Jack, Yuichi, and I focused on an analysis of the hot system negative behaviors, mostly verbal and physical aggression, that had brought the children to Wedico in the first place. Strong emotions were not usually triggered when kids were stringing colorful beads or swimming, as long as all was going well. They flared up if one child deliberately wrecked the tower that another child had been working hard to construct, or if one responded to another's friendly invitation to work on the tower together by insulting him and cruelly making fun of him. To identify those hotspot psychological situations that triggered the children's aggression, the researchers first recorded how the campers and staff spontaneously talked about the children when they were asked to describe them. The youngest children qualified their characterizations quantitatively. Joe kicks and hits and yells sometimes. Pete fights with everybody all the time. Descriptions by the counselors and older campers, however, became more conditional when probed, and they were contextualized in particular kinds of emotion-arousing interpersonal situations, the hot spots that triggered the upset. Joe always gets mad would be the first declaration. But after a few more generalizations, they would begin to specify the hot trigger situations, if kids tease him about his glasses, or if he gets a timeout. Guided by these if-then descriptions, the team observed what each child did over and over again during social interactions common in the Wadiko camp environment. Five types of such situations were identified. 3 negative. Peer teased, provoked, or threatened, adult warned, and adult punished giving time out. And 2 positive, adult praised, and peer approached pro-socially. Each child's social behavior, for example, verbal aggression, physical aggression, withdrawal, was recorded as it occurred during each of the 5 situations. This provided an unprecedented sample of directly observed social interactions repeated often across the same set of situations, with an average of 167 hours of observation per child over the course of 6 weeks. These observations also made it possible to test 2 different predictions reflecting different assumptions about human nature and how dispositions and behavioral tendencies are expressed, cross-situational consistency of personality, and behavioral signatures of personality. 1. The classic and intuitively compelling conception of traits expects that in a given aspect of social behavior, like aggression or conscientiousness, people will consistently maintain their trait rank order across different kinds of situations. If we collect enough observations, we should be able to predict how they will behave from one kind of situation to another. Going back to the fallen public figures in the headlines, we should expect a president who is conscientious in his public life also to be conscientious in his private life. Likewise, we should expect a highly aggressive child at Wadiko to be highly aggressive across many different kinds of situations, with some individuals consistently higher and others consistently lower. That's called cross-situational consistency of personality. 2. In contrast, suppose our social behavior is generated not by stable, broad traits expressed consistently across different situations, but by our ability to make subtle discriminations based on how we interpret and perceive the different situations, the expectations and goals we bring to them, our past experiences in them, the emotions they stir in us, the competencies, plans, and skills we have for dealing with them, their importance and value to us, and so on. Then, even the highly aggressive child will be discriminatively aggressive in some situations, but not in others, depending on what the situation means to him. His hot system will make him predictably angry and his behavior explosive in the specific subset of situations that trigger his aggression, his distinctive hot spots. We call this situation-specific pattern of behavior the behavioral signature of personality. Jimmy and Anthony are fictitious names for real children who participated in the Wadiko study, and their behavior provides an example of what the research revealed. The study identified Jimmy and Anthony's if-then situation behavior signatures across the 5 types of psychological situations: peer approach, peer tease, adult praise, adult warn, and adult punish. Each child's level of verbal aggression within each of the 5 situations over the course of the 6 weeks of camp can be charted on a graph. The horizontal line in each figure at zero shows the average degree of aggression within each of the situations that was exhibited by peers at Wadeco that summer. The zigzag lines show Jimmy and Anthony's distinctive patterns of deviation from that average. They reveal each child's unique hotspots, the specific situations in which their aggressiveness was significantly greater than that of their peers in the same situations. Verbal aggression, the behavior depicted here, is a euphemism for utterances like, "you suck," "your glasses are stupid," "you're a homo," plus the usual four-letter curses and associated gestures. Jimmy, in comparison with others, was exceptionally aggressive if warned or punished by adults. In fact, Jimmy was much more aggressive than his peers with adults, no matter what they did, even when they were nice to him and praised him. When adults threatened him with impending punishment, he went wild. With his peers, however, Jimmy was not unusually aggressive, even when they teased and provoked him. In contrast, Anthony was distinctively far more aggressive than others at the camp if approached positively by a peer. For him, that kind of friendly overture was the hot spot that triggered his aggression. While being teased by his peers or warned or punished by adults affected him no more than was normative among his Wadeco peers. Most people, even if they have problems controlling aggression, are not likely to be especially aggressive when peers are friendly to them. Anthony is unusual in being most aggressive when people try to be nice to him, a formula for creating a miserable world for himself. He could not be more different from Jimmy, who was fine with peers but had a highly sensitive hotspot with adults, regardless of whether they were punishing or praising him. Although both boys are similar in their overall total level of aggression, their if-then patterns reveal distinctively different hotspots. Once we recognize these, we can begin to think about what they mean and tell us about each person. Because if-then patterns tend to be fairly stable across different situations with the same or similar hot triggers present, mapping them lets us predict future behavior in similar situations, identifies the individual's vulnerabilities, and can guide treatment and educational plans to better cope with them. Stable if-then behavioral signatures. Since the Wadeco research, studies by other researchers with other populations and types of behavior have shown that stable if-then patterns characterize most people when their behavior is closely examined. The behavioral signature of personality specifies what the individual does predictably if particular situational triggers occur. These behavioral signatures have been found with adults as well as children, and for everything from conscientiousness and sociability to anxiety and stress. Collectively, these findings contradict the classic and intuitively accepted trait assumption that people will be highly consistent across many different kinds of situations. What is stable and consistent is each individual's distinctive if-then pattern. The patterns help us predict not just how much of a particular behavior trait a person will exhibit, but when and where he or she will behave that way. This information opens a window into what drives the behavior and how it might change. What we found for aggression at Wadeco was also true for conscientiousness among students at Carleton College in Minnesota. That story began more than 5 years before the Wadeco studies, when Philip K. Peek, friendly and smiling, sauntered into my office at Stanford in the fall of 1978. He had just completed his undergraduate studies at Carleton, wanted to work with me for a doctorate in psychology, and needed a place to securely store the many boxes packed with fresh data that he had brought with him. It was and still is the only time in my career that a student arrived not just with a good idea, but with the enormous amount of data needed to test it. While still a college student, Phil had worked with Neil Lutsky, his advisor at Carleton, and had systematically tracked the behavior of Carleton College students across a set of different situations over the course of many months. He had assessed the students on different measures of college conscientiousness that had been selected by the students themselves. The measures ranged from class attendance to keeping appointments with instructors, returning reserve books to the library on time, room neatness, note-taking at lectures, and so on. Just as we found at Wadeco for aggression, There was little consistency in the Carleton students' conscientiousness across different situations. And their beliefs, indeed their intuitive convictions that they were consistent, were not related to their actual consistency across different types of situations. The same student who was consistently late for appointments with instructors might be highly conscientious about preparing carefully for exams weeks ahead of time. Then on what did they base those beliefs? Or were they just illusions of consistency? Their beliefs turned out to be linked very strongly to their if-then conscientiousness patterns. The more repeated or stable these patterns were over time, the more the students felt that they were consistently conscientious across different situations. They believed they were consistent because they knew their predictable, long-standing if-then behavior signatures. A Carleton College student thought he was consistent in his conscientiousness at school because he knew, for example, that he was always punctual for class and for appointments with professors. And he also knew that his room and his notes were always a mess, and he was invariably late with homework assignments. It is the stability of our if-then patterns over time that leads us to think that we consistently exhibit a particular trait. Our intuition of consistency is neither paradoxical nor illusory. It is just not the kind of consistency that researchers had been looking for during much of the last century. That is useful to know because it tells us where to look if we want to predict what other people will do, as well as what we ourselves are likely to do. These findings made it easier for me to answer reporters' questions about whether or not President Clinton was trustworthy. Nighttime behavior with White House interns in the Oval Office should not be expected to predict conscientiousness and responsibility regarding a president's behavior when he deals with heads of state to negotiate an agreement in the Rose Garden the next morning. When asked, who is the real Bill Clinton? My long answer was that he is highly conscientious and self-controlled in some contexts, but not in others. Both sides of him are real. If you want to add up all his conscientious behaviors, regardless of the context, he will, on average, be highly conscientious, although how high depends on whom you compare him with. And how you decide to evaluate his overall behavior, as well as whether or not you like or respect his if-then patterns, depends on you. Mapping hotspots, if-then stress signatures. If you draw a map of what triggers your hot system, you might be surprised. A map of your if-then situation behavior signatures can alert you to your hot spots and when and where you are prone to react in ways that you are likely to later regret. Self-monitoring to discover these hot spots can become a step toward reappraising those situations and cooling them, giving you more control over your behavior in pursuit of the goals and values that matter most to you. Even if you don't want to cool those automatic reactions, you might still benefit from tracking them and observing their consequences. In one study, adults who were suffering from high stress were instructed to use the if-then assessment approach to find the hot spots that triggered their stress. In carefully structured daily diaries, they kept track of the specific psychological situations that activated high stress for them, and they described their reactions to each of those hot triggers day after day. For example, Jenny had normal stress levels on average across diverse situations. Indeed, she was somewhat below average. Her problematic stress signature emerged only when she felt socially excluded. In those situations, her stress level escalated. When she felt excluded, she became distressed, blamed herself, blamed others even more, and became avoidant. Helping Jenny discover the psychological situations in which she did and did not experience stress, and also helping her identify her reactions in those situations, was the first step in devising a targeted intervention to enable her to deal more adaptively with them. While this study focused on if-then stress signatures, the same self-monitoring in a diary or tracking device can be used to map triggers for overreactions resulting from any feelings or behaviors of concern. Once you know the if stimuli and situations that trigger behaviors that you want to modify, you're positioned to change how you appraise and react to them. Self-control cools aggressive tendencies. The highly aggressive behavior patterns that brought children to WDECO for treatment, not only put the individuals at high risk for problem-filled lives, but also created risk for others to become potential victims of uncontrolled aggression. I discussed in earlier chapters how self-control ability can have a protective effect, for example, against the destructive effects of severe rejection anxiety. Might self-control ability also help control the expression of strong aggressive tendencies? The Wadigo research gave us an opportunity to test this possibility. In a study led by my then postdoc, Monica Rodriguez, now a professor at the State University of New York in Albany, the Wadigo children took a version of the marshmallow test in which the treats were M&M's candies, a few now or a bigger bag later. Some of the children spontaneously used a cooling strategy to reduce their frustration. They avoided looking at the candies and the bell and purposefully distracted themselves from the temptation. Like the other Wadigo children, these self-distractors were at risk for problems of uncontrolled aggression, but they were much less physically and verbally aggressive over the course of the summer compared to those who did not use a cooling strategy while trying to get more candies. The same cognitive skills and executive function that allowed them to distract themselves on the test seemed to help them cool and control their aggressive reactions when their hotspots were activated in interpersonal conflicts at the camp. In the split second between starting to become angry and violently striking out, they managed to cool down just enough to stop themselves from losing control completely. Regardless of how good one is at self-control, however, there are situations that can undo willpower and traumatize well-functioning people in seemingly irrational, indeed maddening ways. 16. The Paralyzed Will. John Cheever's 1961 short story, The Angel of the Bridge, shows us how easily the cool system can be crippled. Even when self-control skills are excellent, the psychological immune system is doing its best, and the motivation to exert self-control and willpower could not be stronger. Cheever's protagonist is a successful businessman who lives in Manhattan, and one evening as he approaches the George Washington Bridge to get home, a violent thunderstorm suddenly strikes full force. The wind is ferocious, the huge bridge feels as if it is swaying, and our nameless protagonist, let's call him Bridge Man, panics at the terrifying thought that the bridge will collapse. He manages to make it back home, but he soon discovers that he has developed an incapacitating fear, not just of that particular bridge, but of other bridges as well. Bridge Man's work requires him to frequently traverse bridges, and he desperately tries to use willpower to get over his fear. But all his efforts fail, and he becomes increasingly depressed, ruminating that he is spiraling out of control. Hot Connections. When Bridge Man was crossing the George Washington Bridge as the storm suddenly hit, the structure that he had calmly crossed so often in the past changed its emotional impact for him. Overwhelmed by stress, his hot system automatically associated the previously neutral bridge with the terrifying emotional experience that he had on it when he felt it swaying. He panicked, thinking that it was splitting, and he imagined himself being hurled into the turbulent waters below. When a neutral stimulus, like a strong and beautiful bridge, becomes associated in the hot system with an intense fear experience, the fear can easily generalize to many other related but previously neutral stimuli, in this case to other big bridges high above water. Within the hot memories of his amygdala, even the thought of crossing a large bridge subsequently reactivated his panic in the storm. No matter how hard Bridge Man tried to use his cool system to reappraise the experience, to exert willpower, to rethink his plight, to self-distance and gain perspective, it was impossible for him to get over it by exerting sheer will. When such hot connections form between an innate fear response and a previously neutral stimulus, we can become as helpless as the dogs in the laboratory studies of classical fear conditioning that took place early in the last century. The unfortunate dogs received an electric shock every time a buzzer sounded, and they soon became the buzzer's emotional victims. Even when it no longer signaled electric shock, they still became terrified. Willpower and cooling skills do not help people overcome this kind of collateral damage. Bridgeman's bridge-crossing behavior was no longer within his control. It was under stimulus control, ruled automatically and reflexively by his HOT system. Consequently, all his efforts to exert willpower and be tougher failed, making him increasingly desperate, even fearing that he was losing his mind. Happily, in Cheever's story, an angel rescued Bridgeman. It happened one sunny day when he could not find a bridge-free route to his destination, and as he neared the bridge he had to cross, his terror returned. Unable to go on, he had to pull to the side of the road. Then a lovely, angel-like young girl carrying a small harp approached and asked to hitch a ride with him. As she serenaded him across the long bridge with a sweet folk song, his fear dissolved. Bridgeman still remained careful to avoid the George Washington Bridge, but crossing other bridges soon became routine once again. Cheever's story anticipated cognitive behavior therapy by many years and flew in the face of the then-dominant medical disease model of psychological problems. In the medical model, it is essential for the physician to separate the presenting complaint and its potential cause and then illuminate the cause. For example, for a patient with symptoms of back pain caused by a cancerous tumor, prescribing painkillers rather than removing the cancer, of course, would soon prove disastrous. But for psychological conditions that cripple the individual, the presenting complaint, like the terrifying fear of bridges, often is the problem that has to be addressed and removed. The belief that the medical model of illness also applied to phobias was widely shared for many years. The prevalent worry about simply treating the behavior problem, the symptom, was that this would lead to substitution of another symptom and much worse problems. It was assumed that the underlying causes had to be in early childhood traumas of which the individual was unconscious, and that these causes had to be uncovered with a long analysis. Rewiring the connections. In 1958, Joseph Wolpe, a psychiatrist who became skeptical about psychoanalytic theory, took the risk of attempting direct behavior modification with patients who suffered from anxiety and panic attacks, like those in Cheever's story. Wolpe proposed, if a response antagonistic to anxiety can be made to occur in the presence of anxiety-evoking stimuli, so that it is accompanied by a complete or partial suppression of the anxiety responses, the bond between these stimuli and the anxiety responses will be weakened. Wolpe thought that deep muscle and breathing relaxation exercises could help patients develop the needed antagonistic responses to anxiety, and then slowly the relaxation response would become connected to the feared stimulus until the fear dissipated. In this type of therapy, the relaxation response is at first connected to stimuli that are only remotely related to the traumatic stimulus. For example, pictures of small bridges over calm, shallow ponds bathed in sunshine. Then, step by step, as anxiety about these milder versions of the threat is overcome, the patient moves to the next, more fearful representation of the stimulus, until finally the relaxation response is linked to thinking about and ultimately actually approaching the feared stimulus itself. And at this point, if it is the George Washington Bridge, the patient can cross it in a relaxed state. As Cheever's story suggests, this slow process sometimes can be dramatically shortened when the relaxing event antagonistic to anxiety arrives full-blown in the form of a lovely angel who sings you across the bridge, more likely in fiction than in life. Cheever's story was a preview of what soon became the standard approach for overcoming all sorts of phobias without having to wait for an angel. In many studies, the panicked person was put into a safe situation in which he or she observed bold models who slowly but fearlessly, step by step, approached the feared stimulus and demonstrated that they could remain calm and unharmed. At about the same time that the marshmallow experiments were being done at Stanford, Albert Bandura, my colleague while I was there for more than 20 years, was doing studies of preschool children who had become terrified of dogs. From a safe distance, the preschoolers observed as a model fearlessly approached a dog. At first, the model, a graduate student assisting in the research, just petted the dog a bit while the animal remained confined in a playpen. and then gradually she joined the dog in the playpen, affectionately hugging it and feeding it treats. The children who were watching overcame their fears rapidly and were soon hugging and petting dogs themselves. Bandura and his colleagues achieved similar results even more economically for a wide variety of fears in both children and adults by exposing the frightened participants to fearless models acting out scenarios on films. These studies became important foundations for the treatment of fears in cognitive behavior therapies. Bandura's research showed that the best way to overcome phobias is to first observe the fearless model and then, with the model's guidance and support, try it and master it yourself. Using a variety of guided mastery experiences, both children and adults overcame not just fears of dogs, snakes, spiders, and so on, but even the most profound and disabling anxiety disorder, agoraphobia, the fear of going outdoors. Discussing his research, Bandura commented that some of the phobic people studied had been plagued by recurrent nightmares for decades, but the guided mastery treatments even transformed their dreams. As one woman gained mastery over her snake phobia, she dreamt that the boa constrictor befriended her and was helping her wash the dishes. Reptiles soon faded from her dreams. The changes endured. The people with phobias who had achieved only partial improvement with alternative modes of therapy achieved full recovery with the benefit of the guided mastery treatment, regardless of the severity of their phobic dysfunctions. The popular 2010 film The King's Speech showed the effectiveness of direct behavior modification for helping the man who became King George VI of Britain overcome his distressing speech impediment. When His Majesty conquered his stammer, he was able to become the strong monarch his nation needed in a time of war. His sense of self-worth and his personal life flourished. Losing the stammer, regardless of its root cause, produced only gains, no deficits, no replacement costs. 30 years after the king lost his stammer, in a much less dramatic but well-controlled and compelling experiment, the psychologist Gordon Paul assigned college students who dreaded public speaking to different conditions. In one group, they learned a desensitization procedure to systematically relax deeply while imagining situations connected to public speaking. They learned to remain relaxed as the situations became increasingly threatening, from reading about speeches alone in their room, to getting dressed the morning on which they had to give a speech, to presenting a speech before an audience. Another group received brief, insight-oriented psychotherapy from an expert clinician to explore the possible reasons for their anxiety. Still another group obtained placebo tranquilizers that supposedly would help them deal with the stress. The clear winner on all measures, from ratings of their anxiety when speaking to physiological measures of their anxiety, was the group that learned the desensitization procedure. The students in this condition not only overcame their fear of public speaking, but also significantly improved their overall college grades. Helping people directly overcome problems like their speech disorders or irrational fears or facial twitches, which may or may not be symptoms of other problems, does not create worse problems. When done right, it makes them feel better about themselves and improves the quality of their lives. It took many decades and studies like these to finally overcome the worries that earlier therapists had about symptom substitution and to at last develop an evidence-based economical treatment for helping people get over unfortunate hot system associations. Cognitive behavior therapy is now, for the most part, standard practice in the United States. In many parts of the world, however, it has not been accepted or at best is considered insufficient. I recently told a good friend, a practicing clinician who works with disturbed children, about the Angel of the Bridge, thinking she might find the story useful in her work. She smiled, shrugged her shoulders, and dismissed it as a superficial treatment, a palliative, as misguided as prescribing sedatives to treat cancer. My clinician friend believes the bridge fear to be merely an expression of a deep, underlying anxiety. She's convinced that when the bridge fear is removed, it will be replaced by worse symptoms because the underlying anxiety that caused it is buried by repression in the hot system. You need lengthy analysis, she argued, to get to the bottom of it. When I asked her how she would proceed if Bridgeman were her patient, her answer was quick. She noted that Bridgeman's fear was really about falling into the existential void, and the treatment would have to address that deeper fear and its possible roots. I was impressed by how poetic her answer was, but doubtful that it would help get Bridgeman across the George Washington Bridge. Bridgeman's dilemma illustrates how difficult it can be, even for someone usually good at self-control, to overcome the hot system's automatic associations. To summarize, those associations can instantly and reflexively connect intense emotional reactions, especially fear, triggered by the amygdala to the stimuli that were present when the fear-producing event occurred.